You're listening to the ESO Network, your station for all things geek.
Helm, report.
Sir, there's Klingons on the starboard bow.
Starboard bow?
Starboard bow!
What are they doing there?
They seem to be waiting for the new episode of Earth Station Trek.
Science, what do we know about this Earth Station Trek?
It's a podcast that treks through the history of Star Trek, from the early days on NBC to the future on Paramount Plus and everywhere in between.
Navigation, how would one find such a podcast?
By setting coordinates for earthstationtrek.com or by doing a sensor sweep of Spotify, iTunes, or any other quadrant where fine podcasts are available.
Captain, what are we going to do about the Klingons?
We come in peace, Commander. Weapon station, shoot to kill.
Shoot to kill?
Shoot to kill.
Hey everybody, welcome to this week's episode of Monster Attack, the podcast dedicated to old monster movies. And I seem to say this every single week with every single picture that we talk about. But this is a very unusual picture. This is quite unlike any that I have done before on Monster Attack, and it was time to bring this one out and talk about it. Came out in 1974. And it's based on H.G. Wells' story, Empire of the Ants. Now, some of you are thinking, wait a minute, Jim, you've already done a show on a film that was based on H.G. Wells' Empire of the Ants. Yeah, that was the film by Bird Eye Gordon by the same name. But this one is not that. We're talking about what was a very little-known film for many, many years, but it's developed quite a cult following over these past number of decades, and it's called Phase 4. It caught a lot of us by surprise, and when this film came out, a lot of us went and saw it because of word of mouth. I didn't see it on opening weekend, and overall, the film was sort of considered a bomb. It didn't make very much money initially on its release. But over the years, it's developed quite a big following. So we're going to talk about Phase 4. It's another one of these films that was greatly influenced by the whole ecological crisis situation that surrounded the early 70s. And we're right in the middle of it in 1974. We've come off a time when there was an oil embargo. There would be another one, yet a few years later, that would haunt this country. The whole problem with fossil fuels, the pollution, chemical pollution of the waterways, what we were doing to the watersheds, as far as things that were going into the ground that would end up in us. I mean, it was a scary, scary time. Pesticides that were being overused. We had come off of the DDT scare of the 60s, but there were other pesticides like, Agent Orange, which affected dramatically a lot of people in this country whose parents and relatives fought in Vietnam. My cousin died from exposure to Agent Orange just a few years ago. It impacted a lot of folks. So there was a lot going around that was a little scary, in addition just to air pollution and litter and things like that. It was some really serious issues that we still deal with today. Things have gotten better, but they could get a whole lot better than they are right now. And I'm not going to get into the whole politics of it, because unfortunately what happened was both political parties took this on as a political campaign. And so, as is true with just about everything else that happens in this country, nothing ever got done with it. Oh, a little bit here and there around election time. But for the most part, we still deal with some pretty serious issues as to what we are doing to the ecology of this country and of this world. You know, looking at things as a global situation and not just hunkering down into our own backyard. And this was all brought out in this film, directed by Saul Bass. Now, you might say, I don't recognize that name. Saul Bass, who is this guy? Well, this is the only film he's known for, because after the film didn't do well, he sort of faded into obscurity. And it's a shame, because this is quite a thought-provoking film. So we're going to spend the next few minutes here talking about this little-known film that has become well-known by many people, Phase 4. In fact, there's even been films that have come out on the whole subject of the ecological disaster that we're creating for ourselves, how we are killing our planet, and all of that. They make references to this film quite a bit. So it's about ants taking over the world, in a nutshell. And I didn't want to introduce it that way, because you'd think, oh, is he going to talk about them again? No, this isn't them, or the Bird Eye Gordon Empire of the Ants. These aren't ants that have been affected by radiation and grown to huge, enormous sizes. No, these are ants just the same size as we're used to seeing them. And scientists have said for years that if the insects banded together and wanted to take over the planet, they could do so very easily and become the superseding race on this planet. And that's what this is more about. And that's more in line with what H.G. Wells, I think, his short story, Empire of the Ants, was about. That the nature fights back. So many films have come out with that sort of generalized theme. But in this one, they take it all the way. And it's very believable, which for a lot of people, when they saw this, including myself the first time I saw it, it's a little frightening to think about. Now, we had been exposed to another film while I was in high school. It came out in 1970. It was called The Hellstrom Chronicle, which was also a film that dealt with what would happen if the insects decided they were fed up with what man was doing to their planet and they fought back. And that may be a film that we'll pull out and talk about as well, but not too close to this one, because they're so similar. And one of the similarities that they have is that a lot of the camera work that is done for this film is done by a wildlife photographer by the name of Ken Middleham. And Ken Middleham did all of the insect sequences for the Hellstrom Chronicle, using a lot of close-up photography of various insects. So they used a lot of his ant photography in this. And I got to warn everybody right up front, if you don't like bugs, if you just can't stand to look at bugs, you're not going to want to watch this movie. Because there's so many close-ups of the ants in action here. And I mean, they're very graphic. Because this isn't staged, this is real stuff. The insect photography that Ken Middleham did, it's all real stuff. So let's get into Phase 4. Again, I'll put out a warning to those of you who have not seen this movie. I will spoil everything about this movie. There's no way to talk about it without spoiling some of the hooks and things about it. You already know it's about ants wanting to take over the world. The hardest part about this film, and then I'm going to give you this, and then I want to get into the few people that we're going to be talking about, because it's a very, very small cast. This was shot on a very small budget. But the one thing about this film that was hardest to get through was about the first 10 minutes. Because during that first 10 minutes, you see I won't say all of the close-up footage, but most of the close-up footage of the ants that were shot by Ken Middleham. And you're really not sure what's going on. You know the film is about ants. We knew that much from the poster, which is what we use as our graphic to advertise this show, showing ants and one crawling out of a hand of someone and all of that. So we knew it had something to do with ants fighting humans, some kind of maybe a war going on or whatever. But then you see all of this footage. Little explanation, a little narration in the beginning explaining about ant civilizations and things like that. And we learn that the ants are learning to cross-communicate between species, which a lot of scientists have said, if that ever happens, we as a species on this planet could be in trouble because they so far outnumber us. And ants, as we've known from science, they're pretty vicious. One of the most vicious creatures on this planet. And they're also one of the strongest creatures on this planet, lifting many, many times its weight. You know, I see ants moving these big, big chunks of dirt and things around and just dragging things around that they shouldn't be able to do it. They have very strong mandibles that they use to grab on to prey. They have stingers filled with formic acid that they use to kill their prey or to at least put them in a position where they can control them. So it's not very frightening about ants, which is what made, I think, the film Them so effective. Okay, just before I get into the cast here, I do want to say I want to apologize a little bit, folks. I'm just getting over a bad case of the flu. So the voice is in real bad shape. The fever's broken and all that, but it's just, I'm still a little out of it. So my apologies to all of you. And we're going to try to keep this as coherent as we can get. This has a great cast. This film has a terrific cast, led by a very popular American actor by the name of Michael Murphy. And I think the last time on Monster Attack we may have talked about Michael Murphy was from one of his very first roles on screen, and that was Count Yorga the Vampire. Michael Murphy was the guy that owned the VW bus that he and his girlfriend take Count Yorga home in. And then the bus breaks down in the long driveway leading up to Count Yorga's house. And so they decide to make a night of it there in the driveway. And while they're asleep, they get attacked by Count Yorga, and they become some of our earliest victims in that. But then Michael Murphy goes on to do some terrific movies. He does, you know, Manhattan with Woody Allen, Unmarried Woman, which ran forever on HBO, I remember, and it was a really, really good film. Nashville, one of my favorite Robert Altman films. The Year of Living Dangerously, The Front, Shocker, Magnolia, Cloak and Dagger, Salvador, very underrated film. Away from Her, Strange Behavior, another very, very, not strange, but well, it is a strange movie, but a very underrated film. X-Men, The Last Stand, he was in that one. He was in the original MASH. And Batman Returns, amongst many others. Still going strong. He's 85 years old and still acting. And shows up quite a bit on television and in films. And just a very likable actor, even when he plays a bad guy. And occasionally he does. But just a very, very versatile actor. He plays a research scientist in the movie that is studying some strange activity by ants out in the Arizona desert. He is joined by Nigel Davenport. Now, that name might be familiar to some. Most people my age are going to remember Nigel for two huge films that he appeared in, A Man for All Seasons and Chariots of Fire. Other than that, most of the things that he's going to appear in are in Great Britain, and he did a lot of stage work. And continued doing a lot of stage work most of his career. He would show up in some American films here and then. He showed up as the father of Ebenezer Scrooge in George C. Scott's version of A Christmas Carol. He also played opposite Michael Caine in the Sherlock Holmes spoof Without a Clue. And that was his second to his last feature film. Most of everything else was in Great Britain. So unless you're a real fan of a lot of British TV and films, you're not going to recognize Nigel except from those two big ones that I mentioned. One episode, he did appear in an episode of Midsummer Murders, which now is sort of making a comeback on streaming. We mentioned it, I think, last week, as a matter of fact, either last week or the week before last. It has been showing up in a lot of streaming services. And has developed quite a reputation here in the United States. Outstanding actor, just an outstanding. In fact, you're going to see brilliant performances. So Nigel is the British counterpart to Michael Murphy's research scientist, and we almost sort of get the impression that he is the leader of this research that's going on out in the desert. But he and Michael Murphy's character have two distinct ways of looking at this problem. Now, Michael Murphy plays James R. Lesko, and Nigel Davenport plays Dr. Ernest D. Hubbs. So Hubbs and Lesko, two different approaches to what might be causing this problem, and two different approaches as to how to deal with it. Now, our third main character that we're going to be dealing with in this film, and there are going to be a couple of others we're going to tell you about here, but Lynn Frederick. That name should pop out if you're a fan of Peter Sellers, because Lynn was married to Peter Sellers for 3 years up until his death in 1980. She also was married to David Frost for a year after Peter Sellers died, from 81 to 82, and then married Barry Younger after she divorced David Frost, and they stayed married for 9 years until 1991. When she divorced him as well. Lynn Frederick got into the tabloids very quickly after Peter Sellers' death because of a fight over the will, over Peter Sellers' will. And the family got into a big fight with her, and then she got into some fights with some of the studios, and actually became blacklisted as an unworkable actress after that, for being too particular and someone you couldn't, you know, it was just hard to work with and all that. That is neither here nor there. And I'm not here to comment on that, because I just remember that she just, after the big fight over the will, over Peter Sellers' will, she just sort of dropped out of the scene. Some of her best-known performances was an appearance where she played Catherine Howard in Henry VIII and His Six Wives. She had a role in The Amazing Mr. Blunden, where she won a British Film Award as the Best New Actress. This came on the heels of all of that, and this is an interesting film role for her, a very, very interesting film role for her. She has to play a 16-year-old girl. Now, at the time this film was shot, she was 20 years old. So they had to make a corset for her that would tightly bind her, because Lynn Frederick was, quite buxom, a very, very pretty gal. But they had to sort of, how should I say, dumb it down a little bit. She is supposedly a little farm gal, little 16-year-old farm gal, living with her grandparents out in the desert. Now, we don't know what happened to her parents, but she's being raised. We just know that she's been raised by her grandparents. I want to mention some of the other horror films that Lynn Frederick was in. Vampire Circus, which we talked about a couple of seasons ago, was another one that I just want to make special note of, because one of my favorites. And it's really about the only other monster movie I can think of other than this that she appeared in. But she also played in Nicholas and Alexandra and A Long Return and Voyage of the Damned, which came out about the time this was made, and one that I especially liked. Very good film. It's not a horror film, but a very good film if you ever want to check it out. Made quite a lot of runs on cable at the time it came out. So let's talk about a couple other people, which are the grandparents of Lynn Frederick, whose character's name is Kendra Eldridge. We've got Mr. and Mrs. Eldridge. Actually, we don't know Mr. Eldridge's first name, but we know the wife's name is Mildred, played by Alan Guilford and Helen Horton, respectively. Now, Alan Guilford is a British actor. He was with us until several years ago. He died at the age of 78. He's one of the older members of this cast. He's probably best known for American audiences for his role in 2001: A Space Odyssey. He played Poole's father, if you remember. They had the phone call, and he was wishing Poole a happy birthday. He and his mother, wishing Poole happy birthday. That's going to be the one that you recognize him from most. Everything else is pretty much Great Britain again. Very, very similar to the Nigel's character in this as well. Now, Helen Horton is an American actress from Chicago, but she lived in London, so most of what she did occurs in the United Kingdom. Things that she's going to be known for. She took over for Vivian Leigh in the stage version in London of A Streetcar Named Desire, playing Blanche DuBois. Her filmography, not too much that we're going to recognize her from in the United States. However, in the film Alien, she's the voice of Mother, the computer. So you remember her for that. She was in several episodes of The Benny Hill Show. That might be another place that she's recognizable. Other than that, everything she's pretty much been in is out of the UK. And we lost her in 2007. She passed away at the age of 83. She and Alan Gifford are the two oldest members of our cast here. And that's pretty much the only cast you're going to see in this movie. So you've got Let's Go and Hubs. And they've set up a research station out in the middle of the desert. Well, there have been these strange reports of the ants attacking animals, becoming very, very vicious and attacking people. So they forced everyone in this part of the desert to leave, except for the Eldridges, who have stayed. And we see them on their farm. Kendra's a big horse person. She's got a horse she's riding when we're introduced to her and her grandparents. And then one of the more poignant scenes that we're going to see is when they're attacked. And I think what's very poignant about it is the horse is attacked by the ants. Now, you don't really see it, but it's all this attack is going on all over the place, and Kendra's going nuts because the horse is being attacked, and Mr. Eldridge has to put the horse out of its misery. Which, you know, Kendra's like, no, we've got to save him, but there's no saving him. Now, Lasko and Hubs find out from their boss. The voice is done by Robert Henderson, who is he's an American actor. He appeared in a couple of Superman movies, the first one and the third one, and then in this film, Phase 4. Those are like his biggest American films. He plays Cleet, and Cleet is sort of like the guy that is in communication with Hubs and Lesko about this project. And he informs him of this report that there's this farm that's been attacked. The report states that it was a family that did not leave, didn't relocate, and evacuate with the others. So Lesko and Hubs, all dressed in what you would call like hazmat gear. Looks like almost like outer space type wardrobe. We see him get to the farm. We see the bodies of Mr. Eldridge and Mildred Eldridge. No Kendra. But we do see the dead animals. Sheep had been killed. The horses have been killed. And something we've never seen in a movie up until this point that dealt with anything of this nature, but we see a crop circle. Of course, this crop circle wasn't created by aliens. It was created by the ants. Just gives it sort of an interesting hook. And I know a lot of us were sort of scratching our heads because we didn't know about crop circles. You know, I saw this in 1974. I just started my junior year at North Carolina. In fact, this film was released about a month after we had just started back on that semester. And I remember this was, a lot of us were in the theater. Well, I wouldn't say it was a big crowd, but the ones that were in it, we were all like, man, we didn't know what to make out of this movie. But you just couldn't stop watching it. So when the crop circle showed up, it was just sort of like, wow. Now, later on, when I saw, you know, the whole thing about crop circles and stuff and inferences that maybe this was caused by alien technology or whatever, I didn't make the connection. I didn't even think back to this movie on that one. Well, there's a lot of people didn't forget that. But while we're out there on the farm, Lesko and Hubs hear something. They look over. And, you know, a lot of farms that were located not only in the desert, but in the Midwest or had storm shelters. And it's something I wish I'd had back in 2011 when the tornado got me. This would be like an underground type situation dug into the ground and to put you in safety, from tornadoes or cyclones or bad weather events like that. You know, and it had just a little door like you would see in some older houses going into their, you know, an outside entrance to their cellar. And we see this pop open and out comes Kendra. She's in a state of shock, but she appears physically to be all right. So Lesko and Hubs take her back to their research outfit, trying to figure out how she survived this. But more importantly, she can tell them what happened. Now, the interesting thing about this research lab that they have set up, remember, this is 1974. And a lot of this was shot, you know, in 1973 as well. We didn't have a whole lot of computers back then. And the computers you see in this, like, take up rooms. And probably their computing power isn't even as strong as what we get in our phones nowadays. I get a sort of a kick out of that. But they're using these computers to try to make sense and see it, find a pattern into what's going on here. And it's a pretty cool lab. It's like a sealed dome. That way they can set it right in the middle of where all the reported activity was. Now, we don't see it get built or anything. It just shows up. And one of the first things these animals, the insects do, the ants do, is overnight they build these seven towers, geometrically perfect. Lesko and Hubs doesn't know what to make out of them. And Hubs just destroys them. You know, they've got all the information they need from them. They're almost like ant colonies within themselves. So he figures, hey, we got to get rid of some of these ants. Well, the interesting part of the storyline now is, now we see the difference between Lesko and Hubs. Hubs doesn't want to mess around. He wants to find a way to kill the ants. But Lesko wants to try to communicate with them. I mean, it's common knowledge that, you know, the ants have a high degree of intelligence, of social skills. They work together. And again, like we mentioned earlier, the thought of maybe cross-species communication could be the end of civilization as we know it, for at least humans. But Hubs is working on, on chemicals that will kill the ants, an insecticide that will kill them. But the ants are one step ahead of the game. They find a way to immunize themselves against some of the insecticides that Hubs has come up with. Now, while this is all going on, Lesko is tracking down signals that he's able to pick up coming out of the hotbed of activity. And Lesko slowly through all of the, you know, trying to make associations with the patterns with help from the computer. It's almost like doing like a cryptogram. He's able to come up with a rudimentary language that he understands. And he's able to decode an ant message. He doesn't understand what they're saying, but he's convinced that he can communicate with them. Kendra, on the other hand, comes out of her trauma, but she's convinced that for some reason, something she has done has made the ants mad, and that's why they killed her grandparents, and more importantly, why they killed her horse. She's very upset about that. Now, folks, I'm not going to give you a total play-by-play on this. There's a lot that goes on in between all of this. A lot. But Kendra takes off on her own. Dangerous thing to do at night, especially because that's when the ants usually come out. And she heads towards the ants and apparently is killed. She hits a part of the desert floor that just gives out from underneath her. She falls into the ground and we never see her again. In an act of sacrifice, hoping that the ants will leave the humans alone. Well, Lesko is trying to communicate with the ants by mathematics. Now, we've seen this in a lot of sci-fis. Math is being, you know, the language that all cultures would understand. Hubs, on the other hand, is convinced he can wipe out the ants if he can figure out where the queen is. The main hive. He believes that's the whole key. Kill the queen, and the ants will follow. A couple of the ants have snuck into the research lab. They've hurt some of the equipment. You know, short-circuited some of the equipment. They've sacrificed themselves to do that. A chain of ants connects up two poles and shorts. You know, kills themselves and shorts out some of the computer stuff. That sets Lesko back a little bit. While that all happens, Hubs gets bit, and he is suffering a little bit now from the venom that they have stuck with him. Now, we have seen in a couple of scenes where Hubs has tried some of his insecticides on the ants, and initially it seems to work. But like I said, the ants are always one step ahead of them, and they find ways to make themselves immune to it, almost like a bad virus. Well, Hubs is slowly falling apart because of this venom that's making its way in his body. And he's going to go after the queen. He's finally decided he knows where the main hive is. It's a mound of dirt that he has tracked down. And he takes off to kill the queen. But he falls into a trap. Sounds very similar to what we saw happen to Kendra. A deep pit that the ants fill up with dirt, or at least fill him up with dirt. And now, Lesko knows he can't save Hubs. He knows Hubs is gone. And he's afraid now that the ants are going to continue to expand their reach. And again, they outnumber humans. And if they are able to cross-communicate with other species of ants, it's all she wrote for mankind. So Lesko gives up his notion of trying to communicate with them. He had gotten one final message from the ants that showed a big circle with a little circle inside. Thinking that the big circle might be the lab itself, the dome, and maybe the little circle is someone within the dome. He decides he's going to follow Hubs' plan and kill the queen. And he gets to the hole where Hubs disappeared. And he gets down into the hole, but he doesn't find the body of Hubs. He doesn't find the queen, but these two hands start coming out of the ground. And we're going, oh, who's this? Who's this? And it's Kendra. She's alive. Lesko realizes they're both victims of this trap that the ants have set for him. And he comes to the realization, he says, I know what the message means. They wanted us both. That's what the little circle was, inside the big circle. Because the plan, Lesko realizes, is the ants don't want to destroy the human race. They want to make the human race a part of their own. Adapt the humans to their own world. And then rule them. This is where the similarity is between Bird Eye Gordon's film, Empire of the Ants, and this film, because we see that in the second half of that movie, where the queen ant is controlling the humans. And that's the only similarity, really, to H.G. Wells' story that either one of these films has. And in the voiceover that we hear by Lesko, he tells us that he and Kendra don't know what the ants plan to do, but they're waiting their instructions from the ants. Now, there was another ending that originally came out, and that ending went into a little more detail. It showed what it would be like when the ants started adapting the humans into their culture or whatever, you know, adapting the humans to their lifestyle. But that was trimmed by the producers. They thought it was a little too much. I'm a little torn on that. I just saw that footage, which is now available. And if you want to see the lost ending, what they call the lost ending, is on the UK Blu-ray release. So anyone by any chance has that and has a player that'll play it, then you can see it. But there is a clip of it available on YouTube. It's rough. It looks like, you know, there have been some showings of this movie with that ending. And in all honesty, it looks like somebody took a little handheld camcorder in there and just, you know, recorded it off the screen. But it does give you an idea of what it would have looked like. I'm mixed on this because I appreciate what Saul Bass did in the ending. It's a very, very symbolic ending. It's a very surrealistic ending. It reminds me a lot of Salvador Dali, that kind of thing. But I got to admit, the one I saw, and the one that you can see on Amazon Prime or Vudu, a couple of the streaming services, you're going to have to pay for it. None of them have it for free. The one I saw, which was the shortened version, I think does all right by the movie. I sort of like it. It doesn't feel forced. It just, you know, it's such a typical 70s ending. In fact, it actually tells a whole lot more of an ending than a lot of 70s films did. So, like I said, I'm mixing it. Some of you might prefer the extended ending or whatever. And again, you can always catch it if you subscribe to Apple TV. It's available there. But all in all, folks, this is an intriguing little film. And, you know, you have to wonder if this film had come out maybe 30 years later. Imagine this film coming out like in 2004. You know, Saul, maybe you'd had a more successful film. It might have just been too close to all of the talk about ecology and pollution. And, there was so much of it. So much scary stuff that was coming out there. We almost got numb to it. But a lot of it is still appropriate today because of what we are doing to this planet. And what would happen if insects decided to fight back? Anyway, I'll leave that one to you, folks. I'm giving this a thumbs up. I enjoyed it a lot. And I know, like I said earlier, you might not enjoy watching the close-up bug stuff. And if you don't, then I wouldn't recommend this film to you. It might be a little hard for you. But this is very thought-provoking. Much more so than Bert's film was. Really gets you thinking. Not only about the threat and what we are doing to ourselves, but how we would deal with a situation like this. The two different approaches. Communication versus just all-out destruction and violence. Phase 4. One of the more thought-provoking films we've talked about here on Monster Attack. Hey, folks, we'll be back with you again next week with an all-new episode of Monster Attack. We've got Madeline and Shane joining us in 2 more weeks. We're going to be talking about a Godzilla film that's going to be appearing at the Silver Scream Spook Show. Always a lot of fun if you live in the Atlanta area. Check out Silver Scream. And, folks, pencil in August 9th, 10th, and 11th on your calendars. If you're in the Atlanta area, it's Monsterama 2024. A great lineup of people coming. Check them out at MonsteramaCon.com and give you all the information on where the venue is. Same place as it was last year. And the people that are going to be there and some of the vendors. And yes, all of our Monster Attack folks, I believe, are going to be there this year. So expect, I hope, a Monster Attack panel as well. Hey, folks, have a great week. Thank you for indulging me on this post-flu edition of Monster Attack. And we'll see you next Monday.
Everyone these days could use a little support, and your friends at the ESO Network are no different. With the ESO Network Patreon, the cool thing is when you help support us, it's you who will benefit. With 4 tiers starting for as little as 25 cents a week, you can listen to some of your favorite network podcasts early, hear exclusive content, maybe get some ESO swag, or even possibly take a shot at the geek seat. All you need to do is sign up at Patreon.com/ESO Network.
If you were a monster kid growing up, if you enjoyed Saturday mornings watching Monster Movie Matinee, or staying up all night watching the midnight feature, then Monster Attack is the podcast for you. We not only look at classic old monster movies, we share our experience growing up as a monster kid. Join us every Monday for Monster Attack.
This has been a broadcast of the ESO Network. Be part of the crew and help support our shows by donating to our ESO Patreon or by shopping for the TeePublic store, which can all be found at www.esonetwork.com. The ESO Network, your station for all things geek.